Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming as a hobby, all that fun stuff. And it's a regularly scheduled weekly episode. It's, I guess, kind of a special holiday episode in that we're recording it on a holiday, but
yeah,
it's not really holiday themed to it.
Recording it on a holiday and therefore in the same room.
Howdy Thanksgiving. And because that's the holiday it is.
American and, Thanksgiving.
American Thanksgiving for all you international listeners. Today we are talking about a board game. Like we usually do, we're going to pick one board game. We're going to talk about the gameplay, the strategies involved, and then we'll get into the game the design of the game.
Yeah.
So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Lords of Waterdeep.
Lords of Waterdeep.
Designed by Peter Lee and Rodney Thompson. Published by Wizards of the Coast in 2012. And the awards it was nominated for, it won Origins Best in Show Award in 2013.
All right, very cool.
Yeah.
So just to give a brief description of what Lords of Waterdeep is, it is a worker placement game. In Lords of Waterdeep, players are the secretive leaders of guilds vying for political power over the city of Waterdeep. Over 8 turns, players send their agents to parts of the city in order to recruit adventurers, take up quests, and complete quests to earn the favor of the people in the form of victory points. Along the way, you can spend money to build new buildings in the city, which make for more places to send agents to, as well as play intrigue cards that help you acquire unavailable resources or intervene with your opponent's plans. At the end of the game, bonus victory points are given based on unused adventures and unspent gold in your tavern, as well as from your hidden lord persona. Whoever has the most victory points at the end of the game has amassed the most favor and power in Waterdeep and wins the game. So that's the basics of Lords of Waterdeep.
Yes.
So let's get a little bit more into the mechanics and the gameplay of it so that we can talk about strategy and people will know what we're talking about.
Right.
So it is a worker placement game.
Yes.
From 2 to 5 players. And depending on the number of players, that's how many workers you start with.
Right.
And then halfway through the game, you'll get a bonus worker. We have played with 4 players and we've played with 5 players. In both cases, you start with 2 workers. And there are 11 places on the board where you can place those workers. One of those places can hold up to 3 workers. And let's just go over the different places.
Sure, yeah.
So the first place where you can put your workers is the Cliffwatch Inn. This is where you will acquire quests. Quests are cards that have a cost to complete and then a reward. Usually the cost to complete will involve one or more adventurers and sometimes gold, and the rewards will usually always involve victory points. So there's 3 spaces at the Cliffwatch Inn to acquire quests, and they're all slightly different. The first one is you can acquire one of the quest cards. There are 4 that are always face up. Every time one is acquired, it is replaced by a new quest. So one of the spaces is acquire one of those quests and also acquire 2 gold. Another space is acquire a quest card and an intrigue card. Intrigue cards let you perform special actions when you go to another space. We'll get to that later. Yeah. And then the third place will discard all of the cards in the quest area and replace them with 4 new cards. And then you can pick one of those new cards as a quest of your own. The next 2 places you can go are the Field of Triumph and the Grinning Lion Tavern. If you go to the Field of Triumph, you acquire 2 orange cubes, which represent fighters. So you acquire 2 fighters. And at the Grinning Lion Tavern, you acquire 2 black cubes, which represent rogues. The next 2 places you can go are the Blackstaff Tower and the Plinth. If you go to the Blackstaff Tower, you acquire a purple cube, which represents a wizard. And if you go to the Plinth, you acquire a white cube, which represents a cleric. All of these cubes, when you acquire them, they go to your tavern. And then it is from there that you spend them in order to complete quests. The next place you can go is Castle Waterdeep, where you take the first player token. This is like in Agricola, where the first player is determined by a space on the board that you have to go to. So you go there to acquire the first player token so that you go first next round, and you also will get an intrigue card for going there. Then you can go to Aurora's Realm Shop, where you acquire 4 gold. You can go to Builder's Hall, which there are 3 buildings available at any given time, and you can Go to the Builder's Hall to spend gold. It depends on what building you're building. They all have a different gold cost. You spend the gold, and then you build the building in one of 10 blank spaces on the board. Of course, when you build a building, it is replaced with another building in the Builder's Hall area. And then the last place you can go is Waterdeep Harbor. So you go there to play your intrigue cards. There's three spaces here, so up to three people can use this space. Every other space, only one person can use it. Waterdeep Harbor has another special trait to it, where after everyone has placed all of their agents from their, what is it called?
Tavern.
Tavern, or, well, it's called something else.
It's called Tavern.
No, it's called your...
Pool.
Pool, okay. Your agent pool. So after everyone has placed all their agents from their agent pool, then the people who have agents at Waterdeep Harbor get to reassign them. So they get to pick them up and put them in an empty space, just kind of like as if they were playing them there for the turn. So it kind of gives you a bonus turn. The three spaces are numbered, and the order that the players go after everyone's played all their agents when they reassign is depending on the order they've been placed in the harbor. So the first person to have placed their agent goes first, so on and so forth. So that's the basics of what the spaces do. Now, the way you score a quest is important. You simply score a quest if you have it in your available quests. You've acquired it already. And you have the resources to complete it, all of the required cubes and the enough money to score it. After you place one of your agents in a space
for a turn,
then you get to you can complete one of your quests. You can only complete one quest every time you place an agent. So that means, depending on how many agents you have, that's how many quests you can complete in a turn.
Right. And what's notable is the agents you reassign in Waterdeep Harbor are not considered taking a turn,
mm-hmm.
So you cannot complete a quest off of those.
Right, they don't let you complete bonus quests.
Yeah.
Let's see, there's a few other things. I guess the other thing that's important is if a building does not get built by the end of the turn from the Builder's Harbor, or whatever it's called, anyways, if it doesn't get built, then you put these tokens on the buildings that don't get built at the end of the turn. Whenever somebody does eventually build that building, they will get a bonus victory point for every token on the building. So unpopular buildings will be worth points, bonus points, when they get built eventually in the game.
Right. Also, when you build a building, you put a token on it to show who built it, who owns it.
Mm-hmm.
And when a player other than the owner takes that building's action, then the owner gets a bonus as listed on the building itself.
Right.
So, like, there is a building that gives you two fighters and one cleric, and then it says owner gets a fighter or a cleric.
Their choice.
When somebody else uses the building.
Right. So just, yeah, we could probably go over some of these examples of buildings that you might
right,
get.
Yeah.
So there's, the buildings that you build in the city will provide more than average resources.
Right.
Or they'll sometimes perform unique actions. So, for like you said, there's a couple examples of buildings that will give you three resources, usually like two orange and one white, or two black and one purple.
Two of one type, one of another type.
Yeah, but it's always either two black or two orange, along with either a purple or a white.
Yeah.
There's some buildings where you can go there to spend two gold in order to acquire a number of resources. So there's one where you spend two gold to get two cubes in any combination of white or purple. Or there's another where you can spend two gold to get four cubes, any combination of orange or black.
Right.
There are some spaces that are cumulative, where when you acquire the building, then you put a number of resources on there, like one white cube or four gold, and then you refill it, or you fill it after every round if nobody, or not, yeah, you,
yeah.
You fill it after every round. And if nobody took the resources, then they pile up. So
yeah.
The four gold space will give you four gold the first turn you buy it, but if nobody takes the gold from the space, then there'll be eight gold next
turn.
This is a lot like how spaces function in Agricola. And then some of the unique spaces, there's one space where you can acquire a quest and immediately score it for bonus points. So it's kind of a space that rewards you for having a lot of resources available for scoring a quest, but not the quest in question.
There's one that lets you take an action of a space another player has already taken.
So that kind of helps you circumvent the one person per space in a worker placement game that this game has.
Yeah.
There's another one that gives you a it gives you a bonus action on the next turn with like a temporary piece called the Ambassador.
Right. And that happens before the first player takes their turn.
Yeah. It's like a bonus action you get to take before anybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also a few buildings that give you one of any type of cube, which have like a little question mark on them.
Yes. So those are the buildings. And really quick, just to go over some of the intrigue cards that you might come across in this game. I think what an intrigue card does is it provides you with a resource that is more difficult to get.
There's three types of intrigue cards. Mm-hmm. There are utility, which will give you a resource at a slightly above average rate and maybe give another person as well a resource. There are attacks, which often remove cubes or resources from other players' taverns. And then there are mandatory quests, which you give to one other player, and they have to complete it before they can complete other quests, but they usually have a small requirement and a small point payout as well.
Right. There's a couple others, a couple rare cases of intrigue cards that let you take interesting actions. Like there's one that lets you take the action of a building that hasn't been built yet. And there's another that lets you take two actions in a row.
Yeah.
Rather than having to play one worker and wait for your next turn. If you go here and you play this card, you get to take two actions in a row.
There's one that lets you discard a building you own and put another building into play for free. So, stuff like that. But those are few and far between.
Quests are pretty basic. They all are pretty similar in that they have similar costs. Some amount of cubes, plus sometimes some gold. And then they give you rewards, which are usually victory points. And then sometimes they'll give you some cubes or some gold as a reward. Occasionally they'll have special effects. Sometimes they have a continuous effect. Like, for example, each quest will has a type to it. The quest types are piety, commerce, warfare, skullduggery. Is that it?
And arcana.
And arcana. Piety, commerce, skullduggery, arcana, warfare. There's some that will, like, a quest that will give you bonus points later on in the game if you complete more quests of a certain type. There's some quests that give you bonus action. There's one quest that gives you an extra agent called the Lieutenant.
These are all called plot quests give you a ongoing effect.
Yeah, otherwise it's just a standard quest that gives you a one-time bonus of points and then some amount of resources sometimes.
And almost every lord that you're given at the start of the game just cares about getting more points from specific types of quests.
Yeah, almost every lord that you could have as your secret persona for the game will just say, like, you get 4 points at the end of the game for each warfare and commerce quest that you finished.
Yeah.
Or 4 points for each piety and arcana, or, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
So pretty much every combination of two types of quest, there is a lord that cares about those, that pairing.
Right.
The only difference when it comes to the variety of lords is there's one that will give you 6 points at the end of the game for each building you have built. Otherwise, they all just care about these quests. So, I think that's pretty much the most we could describe about this game. That's pretty much all the components. So, let's talk about the strategy of this game and how to win.
All right. The first one is always be questing.
Always remember ABQ.
Well, always be collecting quests.
ABCQ, always be collecting quests, and always be completing quests.
Yeah.
So quests in this game are the biggest source of points.
Right.
So, I mean, we've only given one example of how something could give you points, and that is that your lord gives you 4 points for every quest of a certain type. 4 is like the minimum that a quest will give you, and it's a rare minimum.
Right.
So there's a couple quests that give you 0, but that's only because they give you some pretty good special abilities alongside them.
Right. But here's one thing to note. At the end of the game, each unused adventure you have is worth 1 point, mm-hmm. and you also get 1 point for every 2 gold you have.
Right.
So, like, one quest is 4 adventurers. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, one quest for your lord is 4 adventurers. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to be spending 4 adventures on a quest, you would want to do it towards one that goes to your lord, because that's a better rate.
Right? Fair enough. Yeah. I'm just saying that, like, comes to the points, like, I think relying on the points that you get from the cubes in your store is helpful when it comes to like the end of the game. You'll care about that, but during the game it's like you always want to be completing quests, because they're almost always going to give you more points than so I have a couple baseline rules, and that's it. You pretty much want to gun for the quests that give you 20 or more points without having to acquire more than 4 of a certain type of cube. So and I think it might be a blanket statement that these definitely apply to 5-player games. 4-player games seem to be a little more lenient when it comes to like really managing what you're doing versus what your opponents are doing. So anyways, I say go for the quests that are worth like
20
or more points. Yeah. Maybe even just like more than, if it's worth more than 10 points, you should be collecting those.
I think more than 10. Definitely more than 12. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some 15s and 16s that are good.
Yeah, but you always want to be acquiring them and completing them as fast as you can. And trying to just, like, I recently just played a game, and what I did was I had, like, 2 quests, and I was like, oh, yeah, I really want to complete these. But, it like, just how many players there were and the spaces that I had to go to collect the cubes, it was taking longer than I wanted to collect certain types of cubes to complete these very specific quests. If I had just collected a handful more quests that I probably could have taken care of, you know, along the way, rather than just like tunneling on this one quest that I've had forever.
Right. Yeah.
Then I would have ended the game with more points, right, because I've actually would have been completing quests.
There is no penalty to getting quests and not completing them.
Yeah.
If anything, it is better to get a lot more quests early on, mm-hmm. and then figure out which ones you're going to complete later.
Yeah.
Partially because we mentioned that some quests give you cubes and gold as a reward. Mm-hmm. If you can chain those together to, like, use all of the resources you get in return, mm-hmm. to then go to another quest, then it really quickly boosts up your points.
I will say, though, like, when you're trying to chain those together, there is some quests that will give you like 4 of a certain type of cube. But those quests I've found in this game are some of the most difficult to complete, and they give you some of the lowest point values, it seems like. They'll take like 6 to 8 cubes to complete, yeah. and you'll get somewhere around 10, maybe a little less than 10 points, and then you'll get like 4 cubes of a type. And you see that kind of quest and you think, wow, 4 cubes of one type is really going to help me pay for the next quest. But just like, and that this is the exact kind of quest that I kind of got tunneled on in this last game, was that it took up too much of my time and the reward ended up actually not being that much. You might consider it like it's worth 2 points, or it's worth 2 moves after you've completed it, because you get like 2 moves worth of cubes. But, you know, it takes a great deal of moves to complete it. You'd rather go for quests that only take a couple of moves and give you a little bit back.
Yeah, I'd rather get a quest that gives me, like, 1 cleric or 1 wizard instead of, like, 3 fighters.
Yeah, when it only took, like, 3 cubes to finish. Because mm-hmm. that's way easier
yeah.
to take care of. So, definitely focus on getting those 10-plus quests. And then when you have them acquired, try and use these smaller quests to sort of at least complete quests in between. Like, you kind of want to complete like a quest every turn if you can, although yeah. that's kind of hard. Maybe every other turn.
Think of it like if it takes you 2 rounds to complete a quest that gives you 20 points, mm-hmm. you could instead do 3 quests that give you 8 points, which yeah. would be easier to complete, but give you more points overall.
Right.
Time efficiency is a big deal.
Either way, it's very important to be acquiring quests, and there's three places where you can acquire quests, but two of them will take from the current list of quests, so there's some amount of planning you can do, and the third one will force you to get rid of all the quests available and get a random one from the top of the deck that you probably hadn't planned for.
Right.
I'd say early game, it's definitely fine to take that. People, I think in general, people shy away from that space for most of the game because they just kind of see what they see and start formulating. So it's not an issue to take that space early on. It's probably very good to do that. It might even mess your opponents up who are kind of like acquiring resources before they acquire quests because they plan to acquire that quest. That's kind of a way to like waste their turns almost, which is a method of getting ahead. But yeah, take that space, take those spaces early game, get a lot of quests, and then complete them for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
And when you're getting low refill. There's definitely, I think, two quests stood out for me for their bonuses, for their special abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the Lieutenant quest, obviously, and the quest that lets you place workers on spaces that are already occupied.
Yeah.
So, and you want to do these as early as you can, and as soon as you see them, you want to grab them up. But essentially, the Lieutenant quest is obvious.
Yeah.
We've talked about worker placement games before in that, like, there's a huge swing when you get an extra worker compared to your other players. This game,
there's only two ways to get another worker over your opponent.
And one of the ways kind of wastes a turn.
Yeah.
So it balances out. The only way to get really ahead of your opponents in terms of numbers of workers is with the Lieutenant quest.
Yeah.
So if you see that, nab it up and finish it as fast as you can. The other one is a quest that circumvents the part of a worker placement game that is the spaces are first come, first serve. And that is the double placement quest, which just says once per turn, you can place one of your workers in a space that already has one of another player's workers.
Right.
And this is very good because and I was able to get this in my game. Unfortunately, I got it pretty late, so I wasn't able to capitalize on it. But essentially what this does is it lets you relax about one specific part. It lets you plan very far ahead with almost no risk. When it comes to like what moves you intend to take to acquire resources to complete your quests in a reasonable time.
I especially noticed some of the two cubes, the fighters and the rogues, those spaces kept getting like really competitive mm-hmm. in each game I played.
Yeah. Just the gist of it is that like you can play your first two workers wherever you want because your third worker is always going to go on the space that you want and only that space. So, you know, if you're like, well, I really need to play on the space that gives us two orange and two and a white cube. I really need to go there because that'll complete this quest. But, you know, I also don't want to waste my first turn on just that. There's so much more that I need to do on this turn. I would like to build a building and I'd like to acquire a new quest. And I don't know. You know, maybe you do know that people are going to be going for those spaces on their turns as well. So you're like, I got to get there first. Yeah. This will just let you say, like, I need it and I can do it when I need to do it. But until then, I can, you know, adjust my priorities and I'll just have the safety net of that.
Right.
So those two quests, the Lieutenant quest and the one that lets you place your worker on places that already have a worker on them, are the two that you would definitely want to focus in on.
They're not
expensive quests either.
There's a sort of archetype of quests that you'll see, which is just quests that give you extra resources for different actions.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one I got was whenever you take an action that gives you gold, you get a rogue cube.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's one that's like whenever you gain fighters from an action, gain an extra fighter. And those are really good just for action efficiency. I think those are worse when you're about turn 5 or later because they're all about getting resources, but by then you want to start really getting points.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, though, like plot quests you don't want to do after turn 6.
Yeah.
They don't give enough points end game to really be worth it for the most part.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that the Lieutenant is probably still worth it. at most points in the game.
Yeah.
The double placement quest, like I said, I got it kind of late. And I was able to make up for some deficit by the time I got it. So that was kind of worth it. But yeah, most plot quests that especially will give you like bonus points for playing certain types of quest, or like you said, bonus resources for acquiring certain kinds of resources, those are less valuable after the halfway point through the game.
There is also one more quest that really stuck out to me, which was the one that when you complete it, you get to put the top building from the stack of buildings into play for free, and you own it.
Right. Oh, yes. Yeah. So that, yes, that is very good. Those kinds of quests. There's another one that lets you acquire another quest after you complete it, and then there's one that lets you play an intrigue card after you complete it.
Yeah.
Those are also relatively good. The building one's probably the best, just because the building space is a little more hotly contested than spaces that let you... I mean, it's more limited than spaces that let you acquire quests or play intrigue cards.
It doesn't give you any points by itself, for the most part, unless you're the one lord, but it does have a big investment purpose, because if you get a good building, then everybody will go there and you'll get these dividends over and over again.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of buildings and strategies, so the buildings, like we mentioned, they give better bonuses than any of the spaces that start on the board, but at the cost that whoever owns the building gets a small bonus every time it gets used by another player other than themselves. So some of the buildings are not worth it. Maybe they'd be worth it every other turn, like the stockpiling buildings, just because you don't want to help out other players so much. But the ones that are worth it are the ones that give you 3 cubes, or the one that gives you 4 cubes for spending 2 gold.
Yeah,
those are or the one that gives you 2 of any.
I would say, or the one that gives you like 1 of any and 2 gold, just like
essentially the ones that give you more cubes or harder to get cubes are the ones that are the most worth it. And so you should try, as soon as those pop up, you should try to build those for yourself, because those are going to be highly used by other players and you will get those bonuses. And what's especially good about these buildings is they give your opponents a bunch of cubes, they give you a bunch of cubes when you go there, and when your opponents use them, they give you 1 cube, which is actually probably the biggest thing in this game, because like this game's all about acquiring cubes, acquiring adventurers to send on those quests and get all those points, and having the right combination of each kind of adventurer. And it seems like the people that do the best in the games that I've played are the ones that own the spaces that give you 3 cubes when you go there, and the owner 1 cube in return.
Yeah.
I mean, those spaces, they give the owner 1 cube of their choosing. Like, it's always between the 2 kinds of cubes that the space offers. So the space that gives you 2 orange and white, whenever you go there, the owner of the space gets either an orange or a white. It just seems like when you own one of those, people are going there all the time and you're getting all those free cubes, and that's bonus turns.
Yeah.
Like we like to talk about, which is very good.
Yeah. But you're also, since it's like one that gives the person who uses it 3 cubes, you're gonna get those extra cubes every turn or every round, almost guaranteed.
Right. And they're getting a bonus turn and you're getting a bonus turn. So it works out, but it's better for you, because I mean, if you go there, then you're getting a bonus turn and they're not. So it's at least balanced in your favor. In that if they go there and you don't, you both benefit from an extra turn. If you go there and they don't, then only you're benefiting for it. So on average, you are benefiting more than they are.
Let's see. So I only have a few other things.
I want to talk about the harbor. It's interesting. It's got a very cool mechanic to it.
It's one of like the most unique things in this game.
And I'm surprised, when we'll get to the design, how not complicated it is. I mean, the harbor is essentially a thing that rewards not going for the contested spaces with getting an extra turn. So it's going there. When you go there, you get to play an intrigue card, which can do a number of things like we talked about. And then at the end of the turn, you in the order that your workers are placed there, you get to take a bonus turn by moving it to an empty space. So this means that you're at the end of the turn, you're getting the spaces that nobody wanted, which isn't great.
However, it doesn't really cost you a turn, because ideally you'd have an intrigue card that you really want to play.
Yeah, I mean, you're giving up priority is what you're working with.
Priority for efficiency.
Yeah, priority for efficiency, and efficiency meaning you're taking two turns.
Yeah.
So the whole priority thing, honestly, I don't think I've ever really had a great experience with the harbor, and I'll tell you why. Is it because I don't play the right intrigue cards at the harbor. The best intrigue cards to play, as I think I've found in this game, are the ones that give you cubes.
Yeah.
Essentially, what I think the harbor should be used for is it should be used to acquire the cubes that you need.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's even good if you're just always acquiring cubes. There's these intrigue cards that will give you two cubes of a certain kind, and it'll give another player one cube of a certain kind. And then there's another type that gives you two cubes of any kind, and everyone else gets one cube of any kind. So the harbor is great for playing these cards because if you want two cubes, like if you want black cubes, it seems that the black and orange spaces get taken up by a lot of workers. So you go to the harbor, you don't have to place your worker on the space that's filled up. You get the cubes anyways.
And if you get like one white cube or one purple cube from the harbor, then it's probably likely that nobody's going to take the other spaces, because I like rarely saw people take the cleric or the wizard space.
Yeah, it seems like the cleric and the wizard spaces are the least occupied spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like if you go to the harbor, you're probably just going to get one of those at the end of the turn.
Yeah.
But so it's good when you're acquiring cubes, I think, because it gives you the cubes that you want when other people have taken those spaces away from you. And then, you know, at least you got cubes at the end of the turn when you have to move it to somewhere else. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it just seems like you acquire quests and you acquire cubes. And so the best spaces are the ones where you get cubes. And so the harbor, if you get cubes there, it's a good space.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you have, there's a bunch of other cards, like there's cards that you play at the harbor that will let you take two turns in a row that are okay, but they're not as good as they seem, in my opinion.
That one was kind of weird. It's only really good if you're early in the round, because it technically still uses your other worker, so you would still want to, like, it would just be forgetting two things that you need before anybody else.
Yeah.
I also think it's usually not worth it if you are the third person to go to the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means that, sure, you're playing your intrigue card, but you're also going to have the worst space on the board, like, by default.
Mm-hmm. And we've done the math. I mean, if you've... There's other than the harbor spaces, there's 10 spaces.
Mm-hmm.
In a 5-player game, everyone starts with two pieces, so that means that every piece that's on a harbor is leaving one space open, and those remaining open spaces are the only ones you can get from. There will be the perfect number at the beginning of the game.
Assuming that one building is built each round, there will still be the perfect number by turn 5 when you get the third worker.
Right, but I mean that just because there's always space for it, but that means you're always getting the literal worst spaces.
Yeah.
And so it's only worth it in like a 4-player game where everybody still starts with only two pieces, but rather than, there being 3 open spaces when it gets to the harbor, if the harbor's full up, there's 5 open spaces, which gives, it makes a big difference on the overall quality of space that you have available to you. It's, 4 spaces remaining in a 3-player game, and it's another 5 spaces open in a 2-player game. So it's definitely way worse in a 5-player game and slightly worse in a 3-player game to be the third person at the harbor.
Yeah.
And then, 4 and 2-player, kind of like the sweet spot where the third is still a little good.
Yeah.
Not as good. I'd say overall, only go to the harbor when you're going to play a card that gives you cubes. Otherwise, just go to the spaces that give you cubes or take first player.
Yeah, and if you want to draw an intrigue card, there are some that draw you other intrigue cards, but it's probably better to just take the quest space or the first turn space and draw that way.
I guess as far as like keeping your stocks up, like you should only, the only thing you really need to keep available, keep on hand is gold.
Mm-hmm.
And you should, I mean, just have enough gold to like have 4 gold or have 8 gold to, so that you can spend it on whatever you need.
Yeah. I have one last thing strategy to say, mm-hmm. which is on the last round, actually count the net gain of points for a quest, because if you spend adventures in order to get a quest, but the points that you get from the quest aren't worth just getting adventures for that round. So like if you spend five adventures to get 7 points, that's a net gain of 2 points, mm-hmm. for example. And you could get 2 points by going to the space that gives you 2 fighters.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really only at the end of the game.
Yeah.
Last round.
I mean, you can do that. You can kind of take inventory of that during the game, during regular gameplay. You could just look at all the quests in the inn or the wherever. Yeah, I think it's an inn. And just compare their reward versus their cost point wise. Just compare like every cube is 1 point, 2 gold is 1 point. How many points do I earn? And so how many do I net? And you can focus on those at any point in the game. It's not hard to figure that out. But yeah, it's just most important at the end of the game when you're just kind of scraping by and scrounging every last point you can manage to keep.
Right.
I have 2 more points for strategy. And just like you shouldn't tunnel on one specific quest and waste, you know, too many turns trying to complete it, you should also not tunnel on your lord's factions. It's definitely good to, you know, get some of those. I've seen people have good success by just having like 4 or 5 of their lord's factions completed by the end of the game. But they're not end all be all. It's not worth it to waste a lot of time and effort trying to finish one of your lord's factions when you could have finished 2 off factions anyways. Because, I mean, as long as those 2 factions got you 8 more points, or more than 8 points, then, you know, the one, or more than, I don't know, you just get it. It's just not worth it. The amount of points that it gives you isn't a good enough reward for the time and effort that you might spend. Especially, if there's maybe a quest in the quest area that's off faction for your lord, but you can complete it in a pretty short amount of time, like you already have most of the cubes and gold needed, versus like reshuffling everything or discarding all the quests and trying to find one that's on faction, despite the fact that you might not have the right cubes for it. It's better just to get the one that you can complete rather than looking for one. In addition to all that, if there's a lot of players, there's probably a lot of people that are competing over the same factions as you. So, you know, it's going to be harder to wait for that one on faction quest to appear and snag it before other people get it. I just remember playing a game where my factions were Warfare and Skullduggery, and I just kept like not seeing any Warfare. I didn't know where it went. I just kept complaining the whole game about like, oh man, there's no Warfare. Everything's just Arcane and Commerce. And I bet all the cards on the bottom of the deck are Warfare. And then we got there and not many of them were Warfare. It was just that other people had been taking up Warfare. A couple Warfare had been discarded. A couple people started with Warfare. And so I was just kind of wasting my time and effort looking for these cards that when I could have just been getting other quests and finishing them and getting points. So don't tunnel on your lord's factions. The last point I have is it's pretty easy in this game just to be aware of what your opponent's quests are, just to know what cubes and resources they need so that you can plan for what they're probably going to take on their first turn. So just do that. If you don't know where to go, like which if you need 2 orange cubes and 2 black cubes, and so it's you have to choose between the two, you can just do a quick glance around the table, see who needs 2 orange, who needs 2 black, and then take the one that's probably going to be taken away from you. So that's pretty much all I have for strategy, so let's talk about design.
Yeah, so this game is a gateway game. Absolutely. And as so, it follows a lot of the basic gateway game tenets/principles,
mm-hmm.
such as randomness in the game that isn't the point of the game, but it, you know, helps the game along.
Mm-hmm.
That's mainly the intrigue and the quests and the buildings, I guess. Mm-hmm. It makes every game different, but it also, like, you know, it also helps players catch up if they're in behind and they're not, like, really good at the game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so two quests are dealt to all players at the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
So from that, I think both the last two times I played this game, the Lieutenant quest that gives you the extra worker was dealt in the opening hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that right away, that takes away the ability of a more skilled player to get a serious advantage over unskilled players, just because it was given to someone who was playing the game for the first time, both examples. And then, in the same vein, there's a chance that it doesn't show up in the game at all, that it's just been shuffled to the bottom of a deck.
It's also interesting that, whereas, like, a lot of other worker placement games, you build improvements for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in Agricola, you have the improvements in the jobs and stuff.
Right, like the fireplace and what have you.
In this game, almost all the improvements that are permanent are buildings.
Yeah.
That, like, the plot quests are few and far between, whereas the buildings, anybody can use.
Mm-hmm.
And so it follows the principle that, like, other players can mimic the strategies of good players pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that, you can use a building the turn you acquire it, but it has to go once around the board. Everyone mm-hmm. gets a chance to use your building before you do. So, it's like, you know, that's a really good building, the one that gives you three cubes. I'm going to build it right now. And then everybody else can be like, oh, I want that. I'll take it. And you don't get to use your own building, mm-hmm. which is, you know, perfectly balanced in this kind of game.
I think not making you buy an extra worker is pretty good for a gateway game.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if a player doesn't realize that that's, like, the good thing to do,
mm-hmm.
then it's good to just make everybody get them at the same time.
Yeah, this game makes
even the playing field.
It makes a good compromise where it's still, like, kind of a necessary experience in a worker placement game to acquire more workers. But this game just says, acquiring a worker is a big swing for any player, so we're just going to give it to all of you at once.
Yeah.
And so there's no benefit gained, or there's no advantage gained for anybody. It's just the pure excitement of the game kind of ramping up speed that more places are available.
It happens exactly halfway through the game,
mm-hmm.
which I think is very helpful when you consider that, like, you know, you can spend the first half of the game sort of learning the ropes, and then probably by turn five, even first-time players would get a hold of what the general gist of it is,
mm-hmm.
and then they can use that worker more effectively.
Speaking of this is kind of one of those examples in a game where the game is highlighting something for you, I mm-hmm. think, in that, like, hey, turn five, things are going to speed up, so be ready for that, but also... Yeah. We talked about in the strategy portion that how plot quests mm-hmm. are worse after the second half of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very clear marker on the board that tells you when the second half of the game is and, like, things are changing up. I mean, I think anyone playing the game for the first time could probably make the assumption, like, this quest that gives me bonus points for playing arcane quests is probably not good towards the end of the game. And so they might think, like, in their head, like, what's probably a safe place? Like, if I don't play it before then it's probably bad. And then, you know, halfway would be someone's assumption. If anything, I mean, not because of any kind of math or anything. They'd just say, like, well, you know, halfway, look at that marker there. That makes me think of halfway. Oh, halfway. Mm-hmm. Maybe I shouldn't play it after halfway. Maybe I shouldn't care about it after halfway.
I think on average, about turn four is when people will start scoring their big quests.
Mm-hmm.
I think usually if everybody takes one action to get resources for that quest, it will take four actions before they can really start to score it,
mm-hmm.
at least from what I've noticed. And so it's kind of like right when you're able to score those, it gives the players the ability to work harder and faster towards those. So does a pretty good job with pacing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that I think this game does a few things that are good for a gateway game, but aren't the most interesting
mm-hmm.
for a hobbyist. So, for example, the lords. The lords are pretty boring in the base game, mm-hmm. if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're mostly just variants of the same concept.
Yeah, they're all just the same card in my book.
But I think it helps for a gateway game to not make them super complex, and by making them all just like two quest types, mm-hmm. that helps give new players a guideline on what to go for.
I mean, if anything, this is kind of like when you'll see a thing at the beginning of the game, and you'll be like, ooh, that's a strategy, isn't it? And then you'll kind of focus all your efforts into one thing, and then by the end of the game, you'll say, that wasn't a strategy. I totally lost because I was focusing on something dumb about this game. This game, the first thing that it shows you is essentially a thing that says, complete a lot of quests, and then that's it. And it's like, it's kind of a bonus when you can get the quests of the right type.
Right. I mean, it does show you that quests are the best way to get points.
Yeah. The only example of something else is the one that is building buildings, which I haven't played with. So
it's one out of like 11.
Yeah. It's very rare that someone would get that card, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
And I've yet to see if that one actually matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think like also telling new players that there are like things that they could be going for helps give them, like I said, guidance or a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy in games where when you give them to a completely new player, someone who's maybe not as into the hobby, they have no idea what to even work towards.
Yeah. They're like, yeah, I get points from this and that. So like which of those four quests actually matters to me?
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, the real answer is that all of them matter. It's just whichever one you're closest to completing.
But at surface level.
At surface level, it could just be like, well, that one's the same faction, so that one matters. So I'll just work on completing that. So it is good that it kind of sets them on a path that's a very easy to manage and to track. Path.
It's also like this subjective balancing thing where certain players automatically get more points from certain quests, which means that it's less likely for there to be always one that's way better than all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in theory, there still is, but like, I mean, when you're playing it, it can be hard to realize that one's way better. And even then, some people are okay with the seconds, the scraps.
It's nice that the quests of the same faction, the rewards will usually go into completing more quests of that faction. Pretty much whenever you get a lot of the warfare quests will give you orange tokens, which are the most common resource spent in a warfare quest. And then the same as, you know, Arcane gives you a lot of purple tokens and Skullduggery gives you a lot of black tokens.
Yeah.
So that's also kind of a convenient like pathway that is laid out before anyone who's just taking a glance at the game and needs to formulate a strategy.
Yeah. So by the way, going back to why it's a gateway game and the decisions it's made, let's talk about inflation.
Okay.
So this is something we both got kind of mad about, which is the game has 5 gold tokens, like a cardboard thing that shows this is worth 5 gold.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But gold is almost always in an even number.
Right. For example, almost every quest will reward you or cost an even amount of gold. Most of the buildings cost an even amount of gold to construct. Anytime you acquire gold, either from the space on the board that gives you gold or one of the buildings that gives you... Actually, take back about the building. But when you acquire gold from the board, you get 4 gold. It seems like nearly everything in this game... And when you acquire gold from intrigue cards, it's even.
Yeah.
It's always even, almost all the time in the game.
Gold is worth 1 point for every 2.
Yeah.
And there's only a few buildings that cost an odd number of gold. Yeah, most of them are 4, 6, or 8.
Mm-hmm. Most of the buildings cost 4, 6, or 8. Yeah, there's a handful that'll cost 3.
Yeah.
And there's 2 buildings that will give you an odd number of gold. One of them... Oh, no, it's just one, actually. Mm-hmm. Just one building will give you an odd number of gold, because there's a building that will give you 1 gold for every building in play.
Every building built.
Yeah. In play. Sure. That'll give you an odd number of gold, but everything else is almost always an evens.
Yeah. At some point, I was like, why does it even need to be this? Why couldn't they just cut it in half and tweak the numbers a little?
It's kind of like when you make a scale of 1 to 10, but everything is either a 3 through an 8. You don't actually use a 1 or a 10. You know, why are you making it? It should just be a scale of 3 to 8.
Yeah, or if you're making a scale of 1 to 10 and you do 2, 4, 6, 8, 10.
Yeah.
It's just 1 to 5.
Exactly.
Or if you're doing 1 to 5 and you go to fractions, but that's a different deal. So, like, but I think it helps with the gateway game to make numbers slightly bigger.
Yeah.
And this is, I was going to say, the points are also very large, but the differences between, like, 18 and 20 are very small, almost don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also just because it's fun to have a lot of points. It's fun to have a lot of gold in your hand.
Oh, yeah.
And for a gateway game, I think it's okay to take these sort of differences where it might not add up completely logically, but it adds for a more raw experience.
Yeah, it's just exciting to manipulate a lot of something, to carry a handful and of gold tokens and drop them on the board.
I think every game I've played, nobody hasn't gone past 100 points by the end.
Yeah.
And
speaking of which, I was going to mention this as another thing of, like, a player excitement. There's, like, this thing in games. This game has a point tracker that goes around the perimeter of the board.
Yeah.
There's, like, a thing in games about, like, wrapping around that, mm-hmm. completing a lap. That's exciting.
Yeah.
And this game, it plays it up even more because every player has their own custom token that they flip over to show that they've gone once around the board, that, like, they have at least 100 points.
Yeah.
I played it last night. And there was even a point where people were saying, like, man, I just want to flip my token. I just want to get past that 100. And that's just another, it's like a point of excitement when you get to actually flip the token and see the beautiful 100.
It's shiny, yeah.
It's fun to go all the way around the board. It's a goal. Like you said, it's something to kind of strive for as a player. And like you said, every game we've played, pretty much everyone gets past that point.
Yeah, so it's like, you would think, why does it need to even reach that point? But it's fun.
Yeah.
And, I mean, to an extent, games are about having fun.
Yeah, it's just fun to get over 100 points.
Yeah.
Another thing that makes it a gateway game is that there's really only three kinds of resources. They do this thing that in any other game, in a non-gateway game, you might be a little upset or frustrated by, in that, like, rogues and fighters are essentially the same thing. You acquire them at the same rates. You just get them from different places. And the game could be the same game if it was like you can go to the fighter house to get two fighters and two people can go there. But instead, it splits them. It does the same thing with wizards and clerics. It splits those, even though they're functionally the same thing. You acquire them at the same rate. You spend them at the same rate. Gold is the third resource.
Yeah.
Compartmentalizing things like that, or being able to compartmentalize things like that, makes it very easy for people to grasp what they are.
Yeah.
And, it's very, like, after the first turn of the first time I ever played this game, I was like, oh yeah, fighters and rogues, you get them this often, clerics and wizards, you get them that often, and they're worth this much of my time to acquire, and if I can get more, then they're worth this much gold and stuff like that. Just having these three kind of tiers of what you get and how often you get them, I don't know, it's easy.
Yeah.
What else can you say about this design? Anything else?
I don't know. I mean, I think we touch base on a lot of stuff. I think it's a decent gateway game to look at, to think about, like, what makes it a gateway game.
I mean, honestly, I think the only thing that it has going against it as a gateway game is the theme of it.
Oh yeah, it's literally Dungeons and Dragons.
I mean, it's called Lords of Waterdeep, and Waterdeep is an actual city in the Dungeons and Dragons, like, fictional world. The lore of Dungeons and Dragons. It's very heavily, like, the book box art looks like the cover of, you know, any generic fantasy novel, like Trist or whatever. And it's also from kind of like the pre 5th edition, like, really intricate ornate decoration. Like, the box has a lot of, like, weird gold filigree on it.
It doesn't have the modern streamlined striking textures. Stuff.
Yeah. So I think the visuals, I mean, they look good, but they're cheesy. They're,
if,
like,
it was
super
updated,
fantasy nerdy. Yeah, if this had, like, an updated, like, Tyrants of the Underdark look
to fit with 5th edition.
Yeah, but the same, just the exact same game. Or, I mean, even, like, a similar system. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess kind of the flavor of it kind of is necessary for the secret roles and
recruiting. Yeah, but I mean, like, aesthetically, if it was updated.
Yeah, I think this would,
it would be a lot easier to sell people on.
For,
yeah.
Gateway game.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, this is definitely the worker placement gateway game of ones I've played. When we did our The first 7 episodes of this podcast, we talked about Gateway Games and we threw Agricola in there.
As number 8.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Right, right.
Because we did 7 and then we were like, Agricola's not really a gateway game, but it was one of our first games we bought.
Right, so so it was 7 plus an honorable mention, yeah. Agricola. I mean, this just makes it 8, just flat 8. This
yeah.
is the
work the gateway one. 8.
Yeah, the gateway 8. The 8-way games. Anyways.
Grateful 8.
Yeah, so, if the theming was a little more accessible for an average person, although, I don't know, Dungeons & Dragons is starting to get yeah. more and more popular every day, so yeah. maybe
D&D
maybe
now, is picking up Steam.
Either way.
And Steam is picking up D&D.
You know, no. Other than that, it's a great gateway game. Everyone I've played it with has loved it.
Oh, yeah.
After the first playthrough.
Which is rare.
Yeah, it's rare. I mean, we own a lot of games where we'll play it once and we'll be like, oh, that was cool, and then we kind of won't play it for a while until we've forgotten how long it's been since we played it.
And
then
we'll play with some pretty varied play groups in mm-hmm. terms of interest and skill.
Yeah.
Dedication.
And yeah, everyone's loved it. Like, after we played it the other night, like 3 people said, like, I'm going to go pick up a copy. This game is fun. I'm interested to see what the expansions add in terms of new like lords and new quests and maybe new spaces
on
the board.
I think that's a good thing, is if a gateway game has expansions that add complexity for a fair amount, I think that's better than having like one box that has a simple mode and a complex mode.
Or even like a game that has a great, like, a high ceiling of mastery. Yeah. You know, it's at the basic level, you can play it, but, yeah, like, if the ceiling is so high that
if I think about it,
an experienced player will crush
a newbie. If I think about it, a lot of gateway games that are, like, really memorable do that. Like, Dominion, mm-hmm. Catan, technically, mm-hmm. Seven
Carcassonne.
Wonders. Well, yeah, Carcassonne, yeah. Those all have very basic base games, and the expansions added a lot. So that's an interesting thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Might as well mention that I think we're still planning on, towards the end of this year, talking about what our current like gateway game canon is.
Mm-hmm.
We had discussed this idea for an episode, like talking about sort of what we think the essential games are mm-hmm. for stuff like that. So keep your eyes out for that in December.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise,
there's one more weekend in November, right? It's 22nd, 23rd.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So that means you should expect a different type of episode next week.
No, there actually isn't.
Uh-oh.
The next Saturday is the 1st of December.
Oh, well.
Otherwise, that's it for November's. We had a midweek good stuff. So
sure, yeah.
There's not going to be an end of the month.
We'll just make December ultra powerful.
Whatever. We'll make it very cool.
Cool.
What other worker placement games can you recommend?
Well, I mean, I can always recommend Euphoria, mm-hmm. which I think it still has some gateway elements, but it's more complex.
I would recommend Champions of Midgard, which we did an episode on, which is a very similar game to this one, where you're acquiring things from a common area, a village.
Yeah. And it also only has one extra worker.
Yes.
Per player.
Right. Although they are acquired at different times, but it gets easier to acquire.
Yeah.
The cool thing about that one is that instead of acquiring cubes and then just matching them up with quests and completing them like you do in this game, mm-hmm. in Champions of Midgard you acquire dice and then you roll those dice to fight monsters, and sometimes you fail. So there's a little bit of excitement, a little bit of like clashing combat.
Viticulture is pretty good too.
Viticulture, which also has the kind of building structures to make your turns more efficient, but in that game they're only in your vineyard. That game involves a lot of planning ahead.
But it does have, like, random cards mm-hmm. and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cards, the visitors are a lot like the intrigue cards in this game, except you play them more often. All right. So, that's our episode on Lords of Waterdeep. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you would like, you can follow us and leave comments to us on any podcasting platform, as well as on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we talk about all other, and where we post all our episodes and we categorize them. And if you want to go back and check out our Gateway Game series.
Or our Champions of Midgard series.
Episode. you can go back and listen to those and maybe see how this one stacks up to the other Gateway games that we've talked about in the past. And if you're interested in going to websites, you can go to entertainthegeeky.com where our friends Chris, Roger, and Jason host a podcast. What else?
So I am streaming on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream weekdays from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Central Time, Central U.S. Time. I have been playing an RPG called Cross Code, which has been pretty fun. And other than that, I am working on writing game design articles now. I don't have anything out yet, but I am trying to get closer to the point where I can release something. And when I do, it will be on the BG Bros website, the BGB Cast website. And so I will obviously tweet that out, post it on Facebook, etc.
And then the last thing is we want you to send us your questions for our mailbag episode that we'd like to do in December.
Assuming
we have questions. If we don't, we're just going to just knock out some more board game discussion episodes and maybe a mechanical genre discussion
maybe
in there. But we would like to answer questions if we can.
Yeah.
So hit us up on, say, social media and let us know your questions or comments or whatever.
And we will see you next week.
Yes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.